Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Wednesday, August 27th, and I'm Nat Cardos reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, vehicle set on fire outside a Humboldt County courthouse August 23rd. Fall hunting season is approaching, what to hunt and when. Eureka Council accuses Israel of genocide, asks for CalPERS disinvestment. So stay tuned. Those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilcut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region.
On August 23rd at approximately 7:51 p.m., Eureka Police Department officers and Humboldt Bay fire personnel responded to a report of a vehicle on fire on the front lawn of the Humboldt County Courthouse on the 800 block of 5th Street in Eureka. KMUD News spoke with Laura Montagna, Eureka Police Department's public information officer, for more information on the incident.
On August 23, 2025, at approximately 7:51 p.m., Eureka Police Department officers and Humboldt Bay fire personnel responded to the 800 block of 5th Street for a report of a vehicle fire on the front lawn of the Humboldt County Courthouse. Upon arrival, the first officer observed a white sedan fully engulfed in flames on the courthouse lawn. The officer recognized the vehicle from prior contacts and quickly located the registered owner, identified as Stephen Payment, 69 of McKinleyville, standing in the intersection of 5th and I Streets, acting erratically. Based on witness information that a male subject had intentionally set the fire, the officer detained Payment without incident. The investigation determined that Payment drove his vehicle onto the courthouse lawn, exited, and then reached back through the window to deliberately ignite the vehicle. Several witnesses positively identified Payment as the individual responsible. Payment was arrested and booked into the Humboldt County Correctional Facility for felony arson and littering. Payment is known to local law enforcement and has been engaged in protests regarding an alleged use of force incident. His vehicle and scattered papers at the scene contained writings related to those allegations, as well as statements opposing nuclear power. Investigators also believe Payment is responsible for chalk messages recently written on the courthouse sidewalk. No injuries were reported. Damage was limited to Payment's vehicle and the courthouse lawn.
This remains an active investigation, and anyone with additional information is asked to contact the EPD Criminal Investigations Unit at 707-441-4300. On September 1st, dove hunting season opens up in California. It is considered the unofficial start to California's fall hunting season, despite other game hunting seasons already being underway. Technically, rabbit season opened July 1st, and in Humboldt County, archery deer hunting opened earlier this month on August 2nd and runs until September 14th. Humboldt County is a popular destination for both small and big game hunting. Depending on the season, hunters can go for bear, deer, elk, wild turkey, and a variety of resident and migratory game birds. Seasons that are going to be coming up this upcoming fall are deer season, which for rifle hunting opens September 20th to October 26th. Both archery and rifle bear season is open concurrently with deer season. Roosevelt elk season is open from September 3rd to the 25th. For ducks, it is open October 18th to January 28th, and wild pig hunting is open all year round. KMUD News spoke with California Department of Fish and Wildlife Public Information Officer Peter Tira for more information about how the dates for these hunting seasons are decided and what factors are taken into consideration when making those decisions.
Yeah, they are all different. The season dates and bag limits and deer tag quotas, those sorts of things, are set every year by the California Fish and Game Commission. Sometimes they happen year after year without little change. For example, the dove season opener is always on September 1st every year, and that's the earliest date the federal government, which, you know, regulates migratory species such as dove, you know, will allow states to have a hunting season for dove. So in some cases, like with migratory species, it's the federal government that sets the parameters of the seasons and bag limits. California then can follow suit or be more restrictive than the federal government. But basically, there's a process. It's an annual process for every season. And with deer tags especially, the Department of Fish and Wildlife will kind of present our findings from a season of surveys and monitoring and that kind of thing to see if there are any changes needed in terms of cutting back the number of tags, or in some cases, increasing the number of tags. So we've seen, you know, deer tags reduced in some areas where maybe there were wildfires or other impacts to the area that may have reduced populations. Then in other areas, elk being a classic example on the North Coast where their numbers are booming, tags might be increased. So a lot depends on kind of the population year to year. And there aren't dramatic changes, but over time there are some changes that, happen. But it's an annual review process to make sure the season dates and the bag limits and harvest limits and tag numbers are in line with population so that we can hunt, but also allow for continued health and growth of those species.
Despite what it may seem, hunters play a large role in conservation efforts. Not only does hunting help regulate wildlife populations, but the money that is spent on supplies like tags, gear, firearms, and ammunition are federally excise taxed. This tax sends money back to the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, which is then used towards scientific research management. Tira explains further the kind of help hunters provide to conservation efforts.
Yeah, you know, hunters really play a hugely important role in conservation. All the money hunters spend on licenses and tags, duck stamps, all of that goes back into conservation, meaning those monies fund a lot of the scientific research we do, a lot of the management we do, so that it pays for a good chunk of our budget, for one, but also goes directly into research and conservation. Similarly, you know, all sporting equipment, archery gear, firearms, ammunition, there's a federal excise tax on all of that. This is a self-imposed tax that hunters placed on the goods they use in the field, and all that money is collected by the federal government and then reallocated back to the state. So that's another source, a huge source of funding, again, that goes towards scientific research, management. And so really, hunters benefit, you know, wildlife, and we all benefit from hunters and their financial contributions through their equipment purchases and also through their license purchase. And once somebody, you know, typically becomes a hunter, they even get more involved, right? They start joining and become active in conservation groups. California Deer Association, Ducks Unlimited, California Waterfowl. These are all associations that help support wildlife and the habitat wildlife needs, whether that's forest land or wetlands, all that sort of thing. So hunters, you know, give back way more than they take, or just for the opportunity to go hunting. And they really put their money where their mouth is in terms of the financial support that they provide wildlife that all Californians can enjoy and benefit. A lot of the federal lands, the state lands, fish and wildlife properties, but also the U.S. fish and wildlife properties. We have a lot of wildlife refuges and those sorts of things, all funded with and purchased through money generated by hunters. So, and everyone gets to enjoy those, right? Go bird watching there, go hiking. Everyone gets to enjoy those, but those have largely been paid for through hunter contributions.
When hunters go to validate their tags, wildlife biologists with the department are able to get DNA from the animals harvested, which helps get DNA from the animals harvested, which helps them gather more information like how old the animal is or whether or not it has any diseases. Game On News spoke with Kiana Nova, a wildlife biologist from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, for more information on how this works.
Hunting tags provide funding for the department, so that supports research efforts, disease tracking, monitoring of endangered species, habitat restoration, removal of invasive species, and general wildlife management. Hunting helps control population levels of game species while providing the department with valuable data. So, for example, when deer hunters get their tags validated, we request permission to extract the lymph nodes. And with that, we will check for chronic wasting disease. And we can also pull a front tooth, and we can get an animal's age from that. So that'll help us get general information about the population, as well as we can give that information to the hunter so they can get a better idea of how old the animal was that they harvested, and just to make sure that it does not have chronic wasting disease. Chronic wasting disease was just recently found in California. I think it was 2 years ago was the first time that we had a positive detection. It is currently only found down south, but we are increasing our levels of trying to find it so we can make sure that we know exactly where it is, how it's moving throughout the populations through California, and just so we can try and better manage those populations.
Hunting quotas are as flexible as the season dates, and the health of the game population and breeding cycles are taken into account when coming up with the quotas for how much people can hunt a species. Nova explains further how this works.
So hunting quotas are determined by ongoing wildlife surveys, harvest records, collared animals, and dynamic population models. So to prevent over-harvesting, season dates are influenced by the breeding cycles of the animal, the general health of that population, and the habitat conditions. So, for example, in the case of elk, whose North Coast populations are growing, tags have been increased to account for that, and more hunting opportunities have been implemented. So, and those are made available through our SHARE program. So it is on a seasonal basis if we can change the harvest levels and quotas.
Hunting offers other benefits to people, too. California is regarded as one of the more difficult states to hunt in, as there are limited public lands and shorter hunting seasons. Even if one leaves empty-handed, they still get to experience the natural settings and nature that hunting zones offer. Tira regards hunting as a lifetime learning opportunity for people, and delves into the different ways hunting can benefit one's life, even in the off-seasons.
Yeah, the best practices, of course, are just, be safe, first and foremost, follow the laws, and spend some time in the off season, even though we're kind of here on the precipice of hunting seasons now, but, spend some time in the off season, improving your skills, right? Whether that's practicing your archery or your shooting, or your duck calling or your scouting, hunting really offers lifetime learning for people. They can do it their whole lives and enjoy different aspects of it. And I think what people don't realize is hunting is hard, right? Especially in California. Hunters are far more unsuccessful than they are successful. But that's okay because it makes the success is that much more sweet. And so spend time practicing your craft, sharpening your skills, give back to conservation, get active in your local conservation groups, and just enjoy a very special time outdoors. I often say, a hunting license is a passport, because with a hunting license, you get to explore parts of California, places in California that the average person never goes, right? The average person is not walking through a wetland at 5:30 in the morning. They're not out in the mountains necessarily in October. So it really is a passport to see another part of California that a lot of people just don't see in their everyday lives.
Humboldt County offers its own unique experience with hunting as well, as it's such a unique area with coastal forests and a diversity of game species. When speaking about hunting in this county, Nova praises the area's diversity of habitat and game.
I might be a little biased just because I'm a biologist for this area, and I love this area, but Humboldt County is one of the best areas. It's one of a kind for our variety in habitat, such as oceanfront forests. This variety in habitat leads to a large diversity of game species in a single county. We have elk hunts that are easily accessible through our share hunt or property access that makes it so anybody has the opportunity to be able to hunt such an iconic species. We have a plethora of wildlife to hunt, from large to small mammals to waterfowl. Anyone with a valid hunting license can utilize the public land we have around here. So you can waterfowl hunt at the Humboldt Bay National Wildlife Refuge. You can hunt on Forest Service or BLM properties. And it's a beautiful place no matter where you're going to go.
For those that are just getting into the outdoor sport, there's a plethora of resources to get information on where to hunt, where to find road closures, what hunting seasons are when, as well as much more information. It's important to do one's research before going out into the field.
Yeah, you can start with California Department of Fish and Wildlife website, certainly in terms of seasons and those sorts of things. But there's a lot of resources out there. The U.S. Forest Service, if you're going to spend time in your local forest, where there's a lot of opportunities, you just want to check again for road closures or wildfire closures, that sort of thing. Do do your homework ahead of time. And so lots of resources out there. There's lots of online kind of scouting maps now that folks can have thanks to technology. So we have more resources than ever in terms of scouting and finding places to hunt. And the department offers a number of opportunities as well. So just do your homework, you know. These are like government sites, and they can be a little bit hard to navigate, right? But if you do your work, you'll find all kinds of resources out there for the type of hunting you may be interested in.
For more information on hunting seasons and where to hunt in Humboldt County, the website is wildlife.ca.gov/hunting, where you can locate Humboldt County on their region maps. For those hunting this season, you can get your harvested animals tested for chronic wasting disease by calling the California Fish and Wildlife Department Eureka office at 707-445-6493 to schedule a time. Or you can visit the former CHP waste station on Highway 299 just above Blue Lake the Sunday of opening deer rifle season. The city of Eureka is supporting the idea of divesting from companies involved in the alleged genocide by Israel. Daniel Mintz reports.
Describing it as an important gesture, the Eureka City Council has approved sending a letter to the state's public employee pension fund urging it to divest from companies connected to Israel's alleged, quote, apartheid and genocide in Gaza. The letter, which also requests stopping investments in companies, quote, that facilitate human rights violations around the world, got uniform support from the four council members present at an August 26 special meeting. Councilmember Scott Bauer was absent. During a public comment period, many keffiyeh-clad speakers also strongly supported the letter, describing Israel's military actions in Gaza as genocidal and, quote, evil. Addressed to the board and director of the California Public Employees Retirement System, or CalPERS, and signed by Mayor Kim Burgell, the letter says the council is dismayed by the agency's, quote, unethical financial investments, including in the variety of companies with products linked to the, quote, ongoing military occupation and genocide of the Palestinian people. Public commenters were less concerned about the practicalities of the letter than its intent, saying sending it is a, quote, no-brainer and the right thing to do. They said the, quote, settler state of Israel is guilty of, quote, horrific, calculated, relentless slaughter, and, quote, indigenous land theft. Former Eureka schoolteacher Alice Finan said sending the letter is a moral responsibility.
I read the agenda summary, and the first thing that stood out to me is that there's no fiscal impact in requesting CalPERS divest from holding investments in the settler state of Israel and in several multinational corporations that are supplying military technology, arms, and logistical support that is contributing to the Holocaust and continuation of the extreme violence the Zionist regime is committing against the indigenous population of Palestine. And, you know, we as a socially responsible community that are committed to justice and human rights and dismantling the ongoing legacies of settler colonialism have got to do everything that we can, everything in our power to stand up against these violations that Israel is committing. We have to stop the settler colonialist state because it's not going to stop itself. It's going to keep committing these atrocities.
Several of the anti-Israel speakers identified themselves as being Jewish, with one describing herself as an anti-Zionist Jew. Another speaker differentiated between Jews who support the concept of a Jewish state and those who don't, saying, quote, as a pro-Palestinian, I know that there's a difference between a Zionist and a Jew. Council members vouched for the letter's meaning. Council member Leslie Castellano acknowledged it as a symbolic act, but added, quote, there's space to push for legislation, probably not at the national level right now, but perhaps within California. Councilmember Rene Contreras de Loach asked that a sentence in the letter referring to Israel apartheid and genocide be changed to specify that the culpability lies with Israel and not the entirety of its people. Councilmember Katie Moulton supported the change and noted that Jewish residents are being targeted.
I just want to take a moment to acknowledge that an ethnicity is not a government. Thank you, Councilmember Contreras-Dillich, for drawing the distinction between an Israeli person and the Israeli government. I have friends in Eureka who are Jewish with Jewish names who are receiving threats against their safety and their businesses despite their opposition to the actions of the Israeli government simply because of their ethnicity, their faith, and their name. And my friends, we all deserve safety. I just wanted to express support for the Jewish members of our community, whether they're vocal on this issue or not, that they are neighbors as well here.
Contreras-Dillich described her support for the letter as reflecting an anti-war stance, particularly relating to war's impacts on children.
On a personal level, I've spent my life working with children and trying to do everything I can to feed them, to advocate for them, to foster them, to give them hope, to teach them to read. I've done so many things, and I've made it clear from here before that I've been anti-war my entire life. This isn't a new position for me. But I don't want to invest in what causes suffering for children anywhere in the world.
Council members also agreed to add a general request for CalPERS to, quote, refrain from investing in companies engaged in war profiteering. The letter was unanimously approved and will be sent to state legislators as well. The wider debate about Israel includes strong rejection of accusations that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. Supporters of Israel's military effort say it's not generally targeting Gazans and is a necessary and just war against a truly genocidal terrorist army, Hamas, in response to its warmongering massacre against Israel on October 7, 2023. The pro-Israel arguments focus on the concept of intent and note that Israel has gone to great lengths to minimize civilian casualties, including issuing warnings, evacuation orders, and facilitating humanitarian aid. Many also describe the notion of Jews being settler colonialists in what's believed to be their indigenous homeland as a grotesque anti-Semitic lie. But of the 21 public commenters at the special meeting, only one vouched for Israel, invoking the theological side of the conflict. Misty Clapp read lines from the Bible she described as being, quote, about the land of Judah and anyone who opposes the land of Judah, who is the Hebrew God's nation. After reading the quote, she said, anyone who opposes God's people opposes God himself, and there could be negative consequences, so choose wisely. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
In national news, Democratic National Committee passes resolution on aid for Gaza, defeats one to cut military aid to Israel, then withdraws the successful resolution. KPFA's Christopher Martinez reports.
The Democratic National Committee had a lot on its agenda Tuesday as it debated a host of resolutions to define the Democratic Party's stand on the issues of the day. Among them were two resolutions dealing with the war in Gaza. The first of them, Resolution Number 3, dealt with humanitarian aid to Gaza and an end to the Israel-Hamas war. DNC Chair Ken Martin presented the resolution, saying everyone on the committee agrees the crisis in Gaza is urgent.
My resolution calls for the secure and unrestricted flow of aid to Gaza, which is absolutely essential, and is the position of 44 Senate Democrats who signed a letter recently calling for a large-scale expansion in aid. The resolution also recognizes the complexity of the conflict in the Middle East and calls for a long-term peace through a two-state solution negotiated through direct bilateral negotiations.
That resolution passed. Later came a stronger resolution, number 18. That was presented by Allison Minerly of Florida.
This resolution is straightforward and enforceable. It calls for the end of supplying weapons and military aid as we see the war ongoing and raging in Gaza.
She says the resolution contains items that were not included in Resolution 3, such as actionable items.
The co-sponsors of this resolution and myself will accept edits that strengthen the language urging for the release of the hostages, but we will not accept substitutes that dilute the intention of this resolution, which is to ensure that the Democratic Party will follow the will of our voters and call for an end to U.S. involvement in this particular tragedy. The resolution was drafted in consultation with Palestinians and many folks directly impacted by this ongoing humanitarian crisis.
When it came to a vote, Resolution 18 failed. But then the author of Resolution 3, Chair Martin, stood up to withdraw his successful resolution.
But as we've seen, there's divide in our party on this issue. This is a moment that calls for shared dialogue. It calls for shared advocacy. And that's why I've decided today, at this moment, listening to the testimony and listening to people in our party, to withdraw my amendment and resolution to allow us to move forward in a conversation on this as a party. We need to keep working through this. We have to find a path forward as a party, and we have to stay unified.
Martin's motion to withdraw his resolution passed without opposition. Martin says he'll set up a committee to continue the conversation. Reporting for Pacifica Radio News, KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
In National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The federal government is in the process of rewriting the rules for how it issues federal contracts, which has some Alaska Native organizations concerned. Ayolna Naiden with the Alaska Desk has more.
Christopher Slotty is an attorney who works with Alaska Native villages, regional corporations, and tribal governments. He was previously a vice president of the Old Harbor Native Corporation. Slotty says that over the years, more and more Native corporations have turned to federal contracts for revenue, which then gets paid out to shareholders. But he says this could change.
If there is a reduction in federal contracting dollars available to Alaska Native corporations, or they don't have as much success in that arena, they would reduce in size, at least on a revenue basis, which could have an impact on dividends.
The concern is that the federal government is currently rewriting its rules for awarding contracts. That's a result of an executive order President Trump signed in April. It directs the government to remove unnecessary contracting rules that are not required by statute. In 2021, Alaska Native corporations received more than $11 billion from federal contract revenue, according to data from the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. Slotty says that in part, ANC's participation in federal contracts has grown because Congress gave tribes and corporations easier access to the U.S. Small Business Administration programs.
It provides a little bit more level playing field for ANCs to compete for work. They don't have to compete with like Boeing or Northrop Grumman, right? These really massive multinational companies.
One worry Alaska Native contractors have is that the government might remove something called the Rule of Two. But it directs government agencies to set aside projects to small businesses if two or more small businesses are able to do them. Slotty says that eliminating the rule could make it difficult for small businesses, including Native contractors, to compete for the work. I am Alona Naiden.
The sci-fi comedy series Resident Alien has ended its fourth and final season, leaving First Nations actor Gary Farmer weighing his next opportunity. Brian Bull, senior reporter for Buffalo's Fire, caught up with Farmer recently in Albuquerque.
Resident Alien not only features the titular extraterrestrial running amok in Colorado, but also several members of the Ute tribe, including Dam 12 Trees. Farmer plays the tribal elder and diner owner, who's the adoptive father to Asta 12 Trees. When not wrestling with alien mayhem, the story often turns to happenings with the Native community. In the sixth episode of the fourth season, Harry the Alien observes his first powwow and is consumed with the music and sense of community.
Now, come on. How do you feel?
Feel like you keep hitting me, but I also feel like I'm connected to everything. It's like Wi-Fi.
Farmer says Resident Alien made Native people a part of the story without relegating them to stereotypes or background dressing. Overall, it was a special experience.
It was a real family. I mean, you have a showrunner like Christopher Sheridan. He's a human being, and you can see it in the show. There's not a lot of human beings out there in my business. They got other interests, mostly financial.
Farmer says there's talk of a possible feature film that'll continue the Resident Alien story. But in the meantime, he's playing gigs on the road with his band, Gary and the Troublemakers. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull in Albuquerque.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Larry Lashley, and thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Christopher Martinez, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMUD News is online, and you can find us on KMUD.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Nat Cardos.